This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher are hosted by Anton Angelo and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio, tonight at 7 o'clock, for a podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz. Hi, you're listening to the Sustainable Lens on Radio. My name's Anton. We've got a bit of a treat for you for the next few weeks. Today we've got an interview that Sam has done while he's been tripping around the States. He'll just come to us straight after a word from our sponsor.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
Our apologies for this week's interview. Unfortunately, the sound quality isn't up to our normal standards.
I'm with Stefan Kreitmeier, who is a doctoral student at the Open University and University College in London. Welcome, Stefan. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, tell me a bit about yourself.
Okay, so my biography is a bit weird. I started studying electronic music composition in Germany, then went into computer graphics and computer games. And by the time I ended up with the Open University as a doctoral student, my interest was in interactive tabletops and how you could design games for large groups to interact at the same time and get some learning out of it.
Electronic music, that sounds fun. How did you go there?
It's always been one of my main interests, music and computers, and how you could combine these two different ways of thinking. So the place where I studied, it was algorithmic composition. So you'd write software that then creates music. It's not like playing at instruments with keyboards and guitars, but it's more like transforming an algorithmic way, mathematical way of thinking into synthesizing sounds and synthesizing musical structures. And that structural thinking, I try to then apply that to computer graphics as well, so you could have graphics and sounds in kind of evolving in similar ways. And that then got me and then I thought, could we make this interactive? And then had a little drift off towards computer games. And I was always curious about new ways of human-computer interaction, and that then got me into tabletop games. So that is interactive tabletop games, like giant iPads for 4 to 6 people. And my PhD topic is how you can design computer games for large groups using interactive surfaces. It could be tablets or tabletops, where like really 30 people can interact with the same computer game at the same time.
So is it literally a giant iPad, or are you saying like a giant iPad?
it's like a giant. Well, it uses different technology. So the iPads that we have now, they're very precise because they use different technology. Whereas the large tabletops, they have mostly optical or electrical systems that track your finger that aren't as reliable, and that's why I'm more of a fan of the smaller form factors that you can move around, these tablets, because they're reliable and they're lightweight and you can share them very easily, whereas these tabletops are quite bulky and they're limited to 4 or 6 people, as much as you can fit around that fixed size of a table, whereas the iPads, you can have as many of them as you want, distributed them in the group, and then people can move them around the way they're comfortable interacting.
So is this working like, you know, everyone's got their own iPad and they're not just got their own iPad and playing solitaire by themselves, that they're using that to communicate?
Yeah, so the way we encourage collaboration is actually by taking things away from them. So rather than giving everybody an iPad, we give them, so if you have a group of 30 people, we give them like 8 iPads, for example, and then they would group, but we don't say we don't prescribe roles for the individual players. We don't say, okay, this is your iPad, but we just put them on the table and start the game. And then people start flocking around, grouping themselves around those iPads and starting to make the decisions in small pairs and little groups. And then the way the games are designed is such that everybody on each iPad gets only a little bit of control. So it's only a partial view to the simulation, And that then creates that dynamic that people are not just focusing on their iPad, but then they look at others and they look at other sources of information. They start talking across the table. They start looking at the projection screens we also use to, like, then trying to get a bigger picture of the whole simulation.
So you're trying to use the technologies to support the human conversations.
Yes, absolutely.
So far this sounds like an unlikely thing to have on a sustainability radio show. So tell us what the application is that you're doing this
right,
with.
Right. So our flagship prototype, in a way, is the Four Decades Climate Leader Simulation, which my supervisors and I designed specifically for a series of training workshops that Cambridge University hosts every couple of months for professional decision makers, professional policy makers, managers in large corporations and NGOs that get together for a whole week to get high profile lectures and workshops. And our simulation fills in a certain gap in these workshops where you want people to not just listen, but also have a reflect on their theoretical knowledge and put it into practice. So get some active decision making going in these large groups. So where they can just apply what they've learned and make sure that they've understood or find out how they agree, how they disagree, and how differently they're perceived. So you get them to play the game. And while making their decisions, they also have to justify their decisions in a way. So if I say, we should spend so and so much money on CO2 reduction, and you say, we should maybe spend a little bit less now and a little bit more later, and then how much? Oh, I can see. So the game forces you to sort of ask you these questions, and then by distributing the control across the group, it forces the group to come to an agreement, right?
So tell me who you're working with on this.
So I've got three PhD supervisors. They've all contributed to the design and evaluation of this simulation. One is Yvonne Rogers. She's a professor in interaction design. Robin Laney in the computing department of the Open University. And Stephen Peake, who's a climate change expert. So he writes books on climate change. He's a speaker at these Cambridge workshops. He teaches in universities and executive training. And so that's a pretty strong team. So both from the computing side and from the subject domain.
So the are people coming along to learn about decision implications of, or policy implications of, climate change?
Yes.
Is that the goal of the overall workshops?
Yeah, you have to imagine their employers, the attendees, they are sent by their employers to these workshops to learn about sustainability and sustainable business leadership, so to get up to date with the state-of-the-art thinking and strategies, and to exchange with peers from other organizations. You can imagine, like, let's say, the head of the sustainability department of the Body Shop will meet the head of the sustainability department of Shell, for example, or people from Greenpeace, and the occasional scientists in there. So it's a lot of people from different perspectives, cultural perspectives and organizational perspectives. They get to exchange their views. And then the idea is that they then bring that new knowledge back into their organization and then affect change.
Most of those people would not be naive about climate change and general
right.
issues of social of sustainability. They're pretty much there.
Yeah.
So what is it? What are the workshops adding to that? It's lifting the discourse further, I presume.
Yeah. Exactly.
And you know, as you say, getting them to talk to each other.
Yeah. Which is a unique opportunity, and I think that games can do something that lectures and case studies cannot.
So they'd have some lecture type material, and then is it in the same room?
You can imagine these workshops, they go over several days. They, let's say a Monday, Tuesday, you'd have lectures, one day on climate science, one day on climate economics. And then their heads are completely smoking. They're, you know, this phenomenon that's called death by PowerPoint. Your head is full of information, and then you need to do something with it. Otherwise, you just forget, right? So the simulation game comes in after like 2 days, ideally, to give them an opportunity to turn that into practice.
And that's also how is the game introduced? What's the, you know, do they say, and now we're going to play a game, or is it some other way?
Yes, basically, yeah, that's what it's like. So now we're going to play a game. It fills a slot in the whole conference, 2 hour slot, and my supervisor Stephen Peake is facilitating the game. He explains the rules.
Is it introduced though as a almost flippant thing? You know, here's a bit of light entertainment, or is it as here is a different way of viewing this stuff, or perhaps something else?
I wouldn't say light entertainment at all, but it is in a way a more active kind of activity, which is also highly welcome after 2 days of sitting. It tends to get people out of their chairs quite naturally, and people end up making jokes, and in that sense, it can be a bit of an icebreaker as well. But that's not the core idea.
Okay.
It's not just fun and play. It's not just like a break from the seriousness. It's got the seriousness.
Yeah, I think that's the question that I was asking. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe it is sort of disruptive in that sense that it is a, you know, changing into a different headspace.
Yeah.
And revisit the same stuff, but with a different channel.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So the setup is, you break people into teams?
Yeah. We have a whole group of 20 to 30 people, depending on, it can vary, you know, how many people are there. And then we split them up into two teams. It's a bit like a football match, but so you have everybody playing at the same time, the same thing. It's not like 30 different copies of the game played individually. It's really one simulation, and it's like in a football match. Everybody plays the same match, except that we have, whereas in a football match you have one ball, and in our simulation you have two balls, so to speak. Each team gets their own version of the Earth, which starts off identically, but then depending on the decisions they make as governments on that planet, the planet's economy and the planet's climate change in different
ways.
So within
a team,
mm-hmm.
you have sub-teams?
Yes.
And each one of those gets one of your devices?
Yeah, exactly.
And they are... Is it like Risk? Do they start with Africa or start with?
We don't model the individual countries. We make a very crude decision to divide the world economy into four equal parts that start off equal with the same.
And they are equal in terms of where they start.
Yes, the same starting conditions. We don't say like, okay, you're China, now you're Maldives, right? It's just quarters. We call them regions. We want to avoid saying countries, mm-hmm. but you can think of them as governments. So imagine the world had four governments, right? That's a bit of a simplification, but it makes the whole thing manageable, and it avoids sort of discussions that aren't so relevant for what we're trying to achieve with the simulation.
And what parameters can they see?
Okay, they can see their governmental, gross income, their yearly income. They can see their yearly CO2 emissions, and they can see the global temperature increase, and they can see the damage which comes from climate change. They can see a forecast of the damage which climate change will affect if they stick with the settings that they have right now. By settings, I mean two variables that they can change, which is mitigation and adaptation. Very crudely speaking, mitigation is reducing CO2, and adaptation is ways to make the effects less damaging. So they have different...
And that's the only two things they can change?
Yes, only two variables. It sounds very simple.
Mm-hmm.
But due to the fact that all the regional governments are linked together, all the devices, the iPads are linked together, And if I change my adaptation settings, something will change on your machine as well. Or if I change my mitigation settings and vice versa. So that creates a quite an interesting dynamic.
So when the income is and the damage are particular to your region, but the temperature and the climate change, that is the temperature.
Yes, that's the same thing.
It's
the only variable.
So you've got an underlying model that links income to climate change.
Yes.
Do you tell them that?
Yes, we're trying to make the model as transparent as possible. So, and that is facilitated by the fact that the model is the same thing that they get taught in the lectures as well. So it picks up these core principles like baseline damage, residual damage. It sounds like Chinese to you and me, maybe if we hadn't been to those lectures, right? But so they start the game, they see the interface, and immediately they recognize these units.
Because it sounds very simple. But it keeps them entertained for 2 hours. So there's
absolutely.
There's some emergent complexity.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so they play the game.
Mm-hmm.
Fiddle with your two little variables.
Yeah.
And the people around the table are doing the same, and on the other table are doing the same.
Yes.
And they're allowed to talk within the groups, but not with the other team.
Yeah, the set of rules is very minimal. We don't tell them to talk to each other, and we also don't tell them not to talk to each other. So there's a lot going on. People, at the beginning, they're all focused on their tablets, making their decisions, and starting to slowly talk across the table. And as the game progresses, there's much more talk across the table. People then stop thinking so much in their local regions and start thinking in their global system. And then also comparing how their system is, their planet is faring in comparison to the other planet. So they start then spying on the other team, which is also quite fun.
So you repeat this several times, do you? The simulation several times?
Yes.
With the same starting conditions?
That's a really interesting thing. The first time we deployed that simulation in a course, we played 4 matches, each time with the same starting conditions and with the same winning condition as well. So we said the winner is the planet with the highest income at the end, right? And of course, the way to achieve the highest income is you do have to worry about your climate on the way to get there. And then you play the first match, you have a winner of the first match, you play the second match, might be maybe the other team won, and the third and the fourth, and then you could compare, because all the data of your decisions and the scores and so on, that would be projected on large projection screens, large screens that both teams can see, so they could then compare and say, okay, this is how we got better. And
oh, so you do a debriefing reflection bit between the matches.
Absolutely.
So you can say, we can see that you guys won because you increased the mitigation before the adaptation or whatever.
Exactly. These kind of reflections take place.
Now, is it it's called 4 decades. Do you run it forwards 4 decades? Is that the...
Yeah, the idea is that the game starts in 2010. It's now almost a bit outdated, right? But when we designed it, it happened to be 2010. It progresses in 4 rounds until 2050. And at 2050, we compare the scores. And then the winner is... In the first time we deployed it, we said the winner will be the planet with the highest income in 2050. And that works really well in terms of the game design, the game theory, the gameplay, the dynamics... people then said, okay, we knew that that was the winning condition, but we actually, some of us in our team were more focused on getting the temperature down regardless of income. So we'd like to play the game in a different way. And then we took that feedback on board and said, okay, now you're allowed to choose your own winning condition. And that was very well received. So, then the way we did it was in a very simple way. We let them choose either income or residual damage or baseline damage or emissions or a global temperature increase, basically any of the variables that the model has, we let them define as the winning criterion. And we also let them define if they think of winning as a planet or as a region on the planet. So if you say, right?
So, that's what I was going to say. Can you set a winning condition that says, say, income? Some of us might have a problem with that as the measure of success, but let's say we do for the moment. Can you say, okay, we want to maximize the planet's income, but minimize inequality within that?
Yes.
So you can't just sort of like develop one bit and let the others, doesn't matter about those other three things.
That's an interesting winning condition that I hadn't thought about, but this is exactly the kind of thing that would pop up in those gameplay sessions after every match. They have a discussion. Okay, they decide on the winning condition for the next match, so on. Then,
and are you there like writing code at the same time? So if they come up with something you haven't previously built, you can do it as fast as you can to see if you
yes
can.
Yes and no. So there's some things they are prepared. Some options that we give them, they are computationally represented. Like, for example, which of the variables is the criterion, right? And then if winning means higher or lower, right? You could just equally play for the highest temperature, right? So as a kind of a reverse brainstorming exercise to understand the problem better by seeing how can we create the problem most efficiently in that sense.
Do what we're doing now.
And that's quite a common exercise in executive training. And then people come up with these extra ideas. For example, one thing that came up recently was, okay, we see high income as a success criterion, because of course that means a stable economy, that means good healthcare and good infrastructure and so and welfare. But if your planet goes over 2 degrees global warming, you lose. So that was a kind of interesting game mechanic that the players of both teams liked really well.
So this is a case where the actual outcome of the model really doesn't matter. It's that sort of the criticism of modeling of garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah.
Is irrelevant if what you're doing is seeing the modeling as value in itself. We're not trying to say, what you need to do is go home and you need to set mitigation at 43 and this at 29 and, do that to your council and we'll all be right.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So the core of this whole exercise is, let's say the modeling has to be good enough to represent something that is true. Right?
Or at least not wrong.
Yeah. Or at least at the very least gets your thinking into a certain, or at least triggers a discussion that is uniquely valuable that you couldn't have any other way. Right? That would make makes the exercise worthwhile. I was about to say something else. So you'd have these formally agreed winning conditions in the model, saying like the selection of the variable, and the selection of high or low, and the selection of per planet or per region. But apart from that, since the game is facilitated by a climate change expert, who's also a teacher and he's very good at managing groups. The groups are free to like agree on anything that they think, right? You can say like the winner is the team with the most beautiful players, right? Just as an extreme case, but yeah, they can make up any informal agreement and then say, okay, that's what we're playing for. That's kind of cool. It's something that you don't get in a single player computer game, right?
So if I was to say I really think it would be interesting for a group to explore starting off with a very unequal distribution.
We've thought about that as well, yeah.
And then set a rule that it's got to be equal at the end.
Yeah. All these things we could do. We thought about that, and it would be interesting to see what kind of discussions come out of that, right? And it's
those discussions that are of the value, isn't it?
Exactly.
So how are you capturing those?
Yeah.
For research purposes, you're capturing them?
Yes, we're doing audio and video recording. Players give their consent to being filmed from four corners of the room. So we're trying to capture everything that's going on, and we have recording devices on the tables. Of course, you can't record 30 people and capture what everybody says. Even if you could do that, you couldn't capture what everybody hears. So you have to imagine there's 10 conversations going on at the same time in a very heated moment of discussion. And then from a research perspective, it's very hard to tell for an outsider what everybody hears. Not everybody knows what everybody hears. But then in the debriefing discussions, it's different. You have one person talking at the same time and then speaking for the group or speaking for themselves, and then someone in the group disagrees, and then you get a feel for how the discussions turn out.
Really. And are you classifying those, or you're doing stuff with that recording? I presume someone's transcribing it or analyzing it.
Yeah, the debriefing discussions get transcribed.
You're not doing that, are you? It takes forever.
Yeah, I'm doing that. It does take forever, yeah. Transcription is a very tiresome process. But also the video analysis is quite a challenge. We have 30 people, and they're all, like, buzzing around, you have to imagine. It's quite a dense crowd.
But it's a very different experience from a single user paper-based prototype or anything, any sort of prototype, and, you know, forcing them to do a... Yeah, think aloud protocol, which is very valuable.
Yes.
But that's the only way you can get them to actually say stuff and do stuff.
Yeah.
But in this group situation, you've got, torrents of conversation and talking. Have you found I don't know if you're at the stage of results. So did they, when you were listening to them, did they say the right thing?
That's a really good question. Saying the right things, as in, did their behaviors change in the right way that we anticipated? I wouldn't say that's not the way we're thinking. But did they say the right things, as in, did they reflect on their learning, and did they reflect on their anticipation and the way, and then their perceptions and expectations of how they think the planet reacts to certain policy interventions. Yes, there was a lot of that going on. So people said, for example, they were surprised that in the model this and this value got so high or so low, and that was sort of, that differed from a particular lecture that they had before, things like that. And then they would discuss about that difference and think about where it comes from, and then also how the simulation relates to the real world, or to the consensus in science, or to the policies. Then what kind of game are policymakers playing?
I mean, it's obviously, as we said at the start, it sounds simple, but it's designed to get that engagement, and it's working at that.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Is there a problem that it's too simple in terms of the science or the?
Yeah.
If only sustainability came down to two levers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that a problem, or is that okay because of the other benefits?
I would say overall it's okay. Every simulation is a simplification, right? You don't have a model that is more complex than the real world, right? Or as complex. If it was as complex, then we'd be living in the Matrix right now, right? Of course, some people do make that point and criticize, okay, yes, but we know the world is not four governments, right? It's much, you have this diversity and, different vulnerabilities and different power structures between the countries and so on. But, apart from that, what it was designed to do, and players really understand that and appreciate that, is to trigger that discussion about the interconnectedness. But we were also very careful in the design of the simulation not to dumb down the science, because after 2 days of lectures, and after bringing in certain quite a lot of professional experience and background knowledge onto the table, you can't just say, okay, we know it's 7.8, but let's just make it 2, because that's easier to calculate with. That's a problem that many board games have, right? When you have to simplify the math into things that you can count with your fingers.
Right? Or on a dice.
Or on dice, yeah, exactly. Or with both cards and or with figures. then it gets really problematic to achieve that fidelity on a political level.
Do they ask for more levers? Do they say, this would be really cool if only it had a happiness lever or something?
Yeah, interestingly, no. That's not something that came out. Some participants said they would have loved to see a bit more a human perspective in it. Some people found it a bit difficult to think in these very mathematical terms, because the game is basically really just numbers, right? And some people wanted to see illustrations of climate change effects. Okay, so there's some science.
So at the moment, you're just showing numbers. Spreadsheet-like.
Yes, but most of the participants, they automatically build narratives around these numbers. So we're actually quite glad that we're not intervening too much from the design, from our role as a designer.
Do you set a scale on the income?
Yeah.
Do you sort of say that, well, I don't know what scale you're on, but you know, 10 is not good and 15 is happy and 20 is fantastic and 25 is too much or something that they're operating in, or do they have to explore that? Set that themselves or make it up themselves?
Yeah, they explore that. So we don't, because we as game designers and not even as climate change experts, we are in a position to say, okay, that is good and that is bad, especially in such a simplified simulation. So the way we got around these absolute values that we don't have the authority to set is we use comparison. So that's actually the main reason why we split the game into two teams, so that they can compare between each other and see. And then it's not that it gets more into the question of better or worse rather than good and bad. So that's also how we get around the problem of punishing and rewarding behavior, right? Because that would be really inappropriate for game designers at such a level, right?
You're working with policymakers.
Yeah.
Would you do it any differently if you were working with 12-year-olds?
That's a really good question. It's on our research agenda as well, and it's we probably use a bit more better graphics. That's an assumption that, right? Kids are spoiled by video game graphics, and probably
these policymakers will be used to looking at spreadsheets.
Exactly, exactly. And they're used to making sense of spreadsheets, so they don't just see just numbers. They see meaning in those numbers, and that is something that we can't assume 12-year-olds to be very comfortable and familiar with. So we probably use a bit of illustrations as well, saying like, okay, 2.5 degrees of global warming is what you have right
this
now.
This is the consequence of it, and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, that's what scientists, mm-hmm. some scientists believe is likely to
happen. So if someone was to come up with several million dollars, pounds to say, spend on this project, what would you do?
That's a really good question. Probably make loads and loads of variations of the game. It's something that we've learned through our design. Although we when we designed it the first time, the first version of it, and deployed it, we got a lot of it right from the start, like the way that information is distributed across the tablets, the model works pretty well, and the information exchange in the group. And so from an interaction design perspective, it's pretty good. What we iterated on were these things, questions about winning conditions, question about how do you allow them to make an influence in the model, so to tweak. Because it's a game about the future, and the future is sort of not completely predictable. So there's the game becomes a different game in reality if we have fusion reactors in 2030 or not, right? Or if there is if there's a massive abundance of oil sort of being discovered, and that changes the cost of mitigation and the effectiveness of adaptation quite dramatically. And therefore, you also need to give people the option to play through different what-if scenarios. So it's not just one, by presenting just one model of the world, that doesn't do justice to the diversity of.
And you're not trying to say this is how you'd respond in this particular case or that particular case. It's trying to come up with a general approach that would be robust, whatever happens.
Yes. So so as game designers, we've moved a little bit from providing answers and then punishing wrong answers and rewarding right answers to the providing questions. And creating an infrastructure for people to get their heads around these questions. That's our approach.
So at the moment it's a game to support face-to-face discussions.
Yes.
Is there a possibility of making it distance, separated people?
The possibility is there. Technically not a problem at all. We're already using web technology, so basically on every tablet you are running a browser in full screen. It just looks like an app, but technically it's just they're communicating with a central server, and that is something that you
could you do it without the conversation with other members of your team, just communicating via the variables?
It might be interesting to look at that. I personally see the main benefit of the whole design in the face-to-faceness, in the things that go on in the room. You have your eyes and ears open and information is buzzing all around you. People are talking all around you. You try to make sense of bits of information, and there's information at the wall projected as well. So it's this kind of situation where all you need to do in order to participate meaningfully is to be there and have your eyes and ears open, be aware, and make suggestions, and so you can integrate yourself into that bus, which you don't get if you distribute that remotely and maybe connected via Skype or something like that. That doesn't give you the same experience and possibly not the same kind of learning outcomes, because we don't have at the moment really good teleconferencing systems that allow you to be aware of what 29 others are doing. So I would say possible, yes, but the benefits are really questionable. Maybe there are other approaches and other games that are better for that purpose, better suited.
Yeah. So you've been running these workshops, and are they continuing?
Yes. The course organizers are very keen to have Stephen and me back using this, deploying that simulation in upcoming workshops. It's been used continuously.
Well, thank you very much for joining me. That's been a fascinating talk.
Thank you.
And good luck with this research.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
You've been listening to The Sustainable Lens on Radio, a weekly show broadcast on Otago Access Radio every Thursday from 7 to 8. Regular panellists are Shane Gallagher and Samuel Mann, and our website, www.sustainablelens.org, is where you can get podcasts of previous shows. You can look us up on iTunes as well. My name is Anton Angelo, and I hope you enjoyed the show.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.